So I signed up for a skydive and I thought I'm just gonna sort of like be like the Kool-Aid jug breaking through the wall. You know, I'm gonna burst through this fear of falling in heights. But by the time I was done doing all the work that I did in the book to try to understand fear and confront fear, I understood it more as a renegotiation or sort of a reframing of the relationship, rebuilding maybe my relationship with fear, which had been so toxic.
Welcome to the Heroic Minds Podcast, where we discover how to get out of our own way, unleash the full capability of our mind, become the hero of our story, and a hero for other people.
From an evolutionary perspective, we've evolved to manage threatening encounters.
I want to do everything in my ability to help them, but they make the call.
We have to do it in a way that doesn't just assume that going faster is going to be the cure-all.
When you suffer and then you come out of it on the other side, you stand a little taller, your voice doesn't shake anymore, your eyes are always up.
Sorry to depress you guys. Self-doubt is par for the course. It's just how you choose to deal with them, react to them or not react to them.
A little tough love goes a long way, and high expectation also goes a long way. But the more you expect of someone, the more they'll do.
I have to keep moving forward. No good comes from going back.
I don't need red tape. I'm not into rules. I'm not into regulation. I'm just going to do this.
Welcome back to the Heroic Minds Podcast. On today's episode, we have Eva Holland, who is an adventure enthusiast, athlete, and freelance writer. She is the author of Nerve, Adventures in the Science of Fear. Eva spent a large portion of her life living in fear. It was the fear of losing her mother that transcended many parts of her life and created a constricting grip over her ability to experience life fully. One day in her early 30s, Eva's biggest fear came true. In response was an incredible journey that began as hiding inside and ordering food in day after day. Then the socially popularized idea of facing your fears head on, and finally, learning about fear, how it works, the purpose it serves, and ultimately, our ability to change it. Eva faced her fears, and that did not work. So she took a different point of attack, and that incredibly authentic, educating, and empowering journey is packaged up into her book, which we only scraped the surface of today in this episode. We talk about how love is often a cause of fear. We talk about skydiving, exposure therapy, EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, and its ability to turn down the fear response. We talk about a newly studied individual pill that can also turn down the fear response. We touch on what life is like for someone that doesn't have a fear response, and a whole lot more. As always, when we have an author on the podcast, the link to Eva's book, Nerve, is in the description of this episode, so I encourage you to check that out. Before we hop into this incredible episode, we must remember to give a shout out to our friends at TrueLocal, high quality, individually packaged, frozen meat, and frozen veggies and frozen fruit. Again, that's individually packaged, on dry ice, shows up in a recyclable box, recyclable packaging. You take the meat out of the box, throw it right into your freezer. And of course, remember these products are locally sourced, high quality for your benefit. And when you sign up, there are no hidden fees, no hidden costs. You can cancel your order. You can change your interval whenever you want. They are honest, authentic, and they are an incredible Canadian company. So that is TrueLocal, TrueLocal.ca. I encourage you to check them out. And if you want to give them a try for the first time, use my discount code HEROICMINDS25, all capital letters, to get $25 off a regular size box and $10 off a personal size box. Alrighty, let's hop into this episode.
I always felt like a very fearful person. And I know some people who know me primarily now or through my work find that sort of improbable, because I write about outdoor adventures and extreme sports, and I do some of that stuff myself. And so I don't fit what people think of as like a fearful or, you know, nervous or anxious person, I think. But I always felt like I was sort of afraid of everything growing up. And the thing I was most afraid of was my mom dying, because she had lost her parents when she was young and had, you know, sort of done the like oversharing single mom thing and told me a lot about her loss and how it affected her. And I really internalized that and thought, I really don't want this to happen to me. No kid wants their parents to die, most likely, but, but it was really kind of an active fear for me rather than just something in the background. And so that was for sure my biggest fear, but I felt at different times afraid of all sorts of things. And right around the time that my mom did die in my early 30s, I had a couple of sort of more prominent fears coming into my life more noticeably, as opposed to, you know, more transient stuff that scares you in high school, but not in university or whatever. I realized that I had a fear of heights for a long time. I hadn't sort of put the pattern together until relatively recently. And then I was like, wait, I've had these different panics. These things always scare me, but I hadn't noticed because I had spent so much time avoiding, you know, exposed height situations that I hadn't really realized the extent to which that fear affected me. And then I had a series of car accidents, mostly winter driving in Northern Canada where I live, and developed a pretty significant sort of trauma response around driving in snow and ice. So those were the two things I was dealing with when my mom did die suddenly of a stroke when I was 33.
There was also a large part in your book about seizures that you experienced at a young age and a connection and a thought there was a connection to that fear. Could you dive into how that, I guess, the relationship between fear and your seizures? And there was a time that I found fascinating where in your book, you talk about not even being not sure if the seizure actually happened or if it was just a dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I had my first seizure in grade 6, I think. And for people who don't know, you can't be diagnosed with epilepsy after just one typically. So I had the one in the middle of the night and I happened to be in my mom's bed because I had had a nightmare earlier and I had, you know, just moved over across the hall. And so she was there, to see it. And we, you know, we got me to a doctor the next day. And a couple of months later, I think I had two more in the same night and then they were able to diagnose me and get me on an anticonvulsant medication, do all the, you know, MRI and CT and all that stuff. And I had had a nightmare before I had my first seizure, I had this real sense of sort of connection between the mental and the physical. And you know, seizures aren't caused by nightmares, but I just had this really strong sense of connection. And I think that stayed with me even after I understood logically that nightmares couldn't cause my seizures. You know, I associated fear with this physical response, this very dangerous physical response. You know, it's seizures can kill you if they last long enough. And so I became really afraid of being afraid. I remember making a huge scene at summer camp because the counselors wanted to make me listen to a scary story. They wouldn't let me leave. And I was like, I eventually kind of flipped out and was like, you're trying to kill me. And they were like, at which point they let me leave. They were like, what is this kid's deal? So it was an early understanding of, I think, kind of the connection between, you know, the mental aspects of fear and the physical fear reaction that we experience, which isn't something that I understood scientifically until I worked on this book, but I think was sort of a, you know, sometimes kids, we have nonsensical ideas, but there's an intuition in them as well.
That's what I find interesting, how it seemed as if at that point in the book, it seemed as if fear started to transcend itself one specific instance to other areas of your life, a subtle background feeling of this fear that became an inherent part of your life?
I think so. Yeah. I think fear can build on itself and it teaches you. Each time you're afraid, you learn something and you retain that knowledge. That's what the fear system does. It teaches us. Fear memories are durable so that we will react differently the next time potentially to a threat. And so I do think any powerful fear experience that you have sort of builds a memory and builds a lesson and builds on itself and can start to sort of reverberate around in your life when you feel fear again in future, or even just anticipating, you know, future fear.
When your biggest fear or greatest fear actually came true, unfortunately, and I'm sorry to hear that and bring that up. It seems like it was a catalytical moment in your life and journey through fear to where you are today. Where I wanted to start was the fact that love and fear are often so tightly bound together and what that means to you when you think of that.
Yeah. I think about that common lyric. I want to be the one that hurts you the most. I think, you know, nothing's scarier than the people we love in a way, because they have so much power over us. Whether that's, you know, to hurt us in more active ways, or by leaving us, by dying, or something else. It's just such a powerful emotion that, of course, there's a lot of fear that comes with it. There's a lot of vulnerability and anxiety around those powerful feelings. And yeah, you know, when my mom died, I felt like I did think to myself, this is my worst fear coming true. Like, it's happening. It felt like on some level, I always knew it would, or maybe by thinking about it so much, I had almost caused it to happen. You know, it was a very strange feeling of sort of my world kind of coming down, but also I sort of was like, of course this is happening.
And your first instinct in the book, it seemed as if there was this thirst to take up some type of challenge, ultra running and channeling your anger and sadness into, beautifully said, into this grim accomplishment, which I think is actually something that relates to a lot of people, is a anger and a sadness and an emptiness or a void that we then put into chasing something to fill that void. How long did that last? Where did that lead you?
It was, in my case, it was more of an idea or an instinct than something I followed through on right away, I think. you know, I ended up spending a lot of time on my couch, you know, watching cop shows and eating delivery Chinese food rather than ultra running. But I liked the idea of being someone who grieved through sort of grim accomplishment. As I said, I wanted to do that rather than, you know, have my life completely fall apart, which felt in some ways like the other option. I didn't, you know, I was worried I would drink too much. I was worried I would be self-destructive, you know, and this other finding a way to channel my grief and anger felt like the better path. In the end, I think I found sort of a middle path. And I talk about this in the book a bit. I tried, you know, solo travel is a way that I've often found to sort of rejuvenate myself. And in this case, it just didn't work. And the lesson was I needed people around me. I needed the people who care about me to support me through this. This wasn't something I could just sort of like moodily hike my way through. And maybe that works for some people, but for me, what I needed was community.
I found that interesting, is because it almost seemed like a few pages later, you say there was almost an assumption that maybe this is just how adult life was. Maybe that's just how life was going to be. The same thing, but a little bit more sad than it once was. And maybe in our minds, we try and challenge that with, I'm going to accomplish something and that's going to fill the space. At least that's how I read it in your book. I mean, it was either living this way or it's time to change things.
Yeah. It felt like, I needed to do something, but also like it was impossible to do something. You know, when you're in it, that sadness feels so permanent and you can't see a way out of it. And yeah, I just thought, is this my life now? Like, maybe I get a little bit less sad than I am right now, but it's, you know, it's like this forever now. And of course it wasn't, but I hadn't been through sort of a deep grief before, so I didn't understand that yet. And I really wanted to, I was both frightened of changing too much. You know, I made myself a rule not to make any life decisions for a year, and any major life decisions for a year after my mom died. Because I did feel this urge to sort of burn everything down or change everything or try to fix everything by, you know, remaking my life, which I don't think would have worked. But at the same time, doing anything felt so hard. I remember, you know, I didn't put this part quite explicitly in the book. I talked more about the ultra running idea, but I said to a friend, you know, maybe I'll do like Cheryl Strayed, you know, early and wild, and, you know, do a bunch of heroin and sleep with everybody. And my friend was like, you know, you could, if you wanted to, you could, but I don't think you're going to. I think that we find ways to grieve that are in keeping with our character often, really, or other pieces of our lives. And so for me, it ended up being, you know, trying to travel, watching too many cop shows, you know, trying to find ways to laugh with my friends again.
Before we get into that first step, because I love the story of you high up in an airplane, and the way you explain it in the book is amazing. But what was your goal? When I start your book, you talk about having more understanding over it, having more control over it. Early on, what was the initial goal? Was it to just be able to overpower it? What was that?
Yeah, the initial goal was in my head framed in much more combative terms, you know, overcome my fear, defeat my fear, conquer my fear, these ways that we often talk about it. I, you know, once I came through the worst of the grief, I had this empowering realization that actually I had faced my worst fear and I had survived. You know, it had come true, and I was ultimately, I missed my mom, but I was going to be okay. And that made me think, well, what else can I do about my fears? Maybe I can face the others and come through them too. And I had these very sort of combinations of conquering fear, which is so often how we talk about it culturally. But by the time I was done doing all the work that I did in the book to try to understand fear and confront fear, I understood it more as a renegotiation or sort of a reframing of the relationship, rebuilding maybe my relationship with fear, which had been so toxic.
Can you take me through that journey up in the sky of, okay, I'm going to tackle this fear, I'm going to overcome it, and this is going to solve everything? Because I thought that was interesting too, that there was the assumption that once you did something, it was going to fix fear and you were totally going to overcome it just because you did something that was extremely scary to you.
Right. Yeah. This was coming from a place of such ignorance, you know. So the first thing I did, as you've alluded to, is I went skydiving. I couldn't think of anything scarier. My particular fear of heights is really about a fear of falling. It's about a sense of exposure. I'm okay in elevators, you know, glass elevators might squick me out a little bit, but generally okay in elevators, on bridges, airplanes. It's really about whether or not I feel like I can fall. And so I thought, well, what's the scariest thing I could do? And it's, you know, fall out of an airplane and then fall all the way down to the ground. So I signed up for a skydive and I thought, I'm just going to sort of like be like the Kool-Aid jug breaking through the wall. You know, I'm going to burst through this fear of falling in heights and then nothing will be the same again after I've done it. Right. And I did go skydiving. I did actually make the jump. It was very much in question whether I was going to go through with it for a while there that day. A friend was supposed to come with me and then she had a family emergency and couldn't come. And so I was there by myself trying to, you know, not quit. And there were hours of delays while I just sort of like held on by my teeth to staying at this site and committing to the jump.
Sorry, I'm laughing because I have a quote highlighted in front of me that you wrote in the book, which was so beautifully said again, is a full sensory assault on my fear response. I thought, what a beautiful way to say it. So here you are in a plane about to conquer one of your biggest fears possible, probably that's under any type of control, jumping out of a plane. And there's a moment where you say right before you do jump that you have the option to turn around. What was it that allowed you to avoid saying, no, let's go back to the ground?
I think it was two things, partly a sense of desperation. My fear of heights had gotten pretty out of hand in terms of how it was affecting my life. The book opens with an incident where I became so afraid in a mountain situation that I endangered my life and the lives of my friends. And so I had to either quit doing the sports, you know, that I love with my community that I love, or I had to figure out how to get control of this thing. Those were my choices. There was no more kind of muddling through that seemed acceptable to me. So I was desperate to do something. The other thing was, and I've always, I have some workaholic tendencies and I've always been able to push myself for work reasons more personal ones. And the other thing was I was committed to trying to do a book. And so I was like, if I can't get out of the plane, then how am I going to finish my book proposal, you know, which sounds so silly, but I've often in all sorts of ways pushed myself harder for my writing than for anything else. And so I think that drove me as well to say, I'm not going to let this stop me.
What it made me think in the book was the balance or the power that incentive has over fear.
Mm-hmm. I think definitely. Yeah. I only mentioned it in passing in the book, but a few years before that I had done this mining job where I had to hike in steep terrain every day doing mineral exploration in the Northern Yukon. And my friends and I joked, you know, I did all kinds of things in that job that I would have never been able to do a year before in terms of the terrain I was traversing. And it was because I was broke and I had credit card debt and this job was paying me $250 a day plus room and board. So, you know, my friends joked that they figured out the cure to my fear of heights was, you know, financial desperation and cash.
And where this conversation, you know, before we started recording, I to bring this back selfishly to my own experience in life. And I never fought as a player when I played, but when you talk about that incentive, I know a handful of individuals that were able to fight in the game or sport, again, incentivized. So it's just fascinating how often we try these cognitive gymnastics and different approaches to fear when it can sometimes be as simple as money or getting a job done, et cetera, depending on what the individual values. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The pressures. I was thinking when we were talking earlier about a really touching story, touching, but screwed up story. I heard about Jonathan Toews once that he, I think by his second or third year, he still hadn't had an NHL fight and people were like talking about it, right? Like, oh, Jonathan Toews hasn't fought yet, as though his hands aren't worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars that he shouldn't use on people's jaws, you know? And so he finally, it was becoming a big thing and he finally had to go do it. And I think they set it up with the, you know, the other team ahead of time that he would fight somebody that wouldn't, you know, go too hard on him or whatever. And he goes to the penalty box for his 5 minutes and he throws up in the penalty box after. And I just thought he must have been so scared and so keyed up about having to do this with, you know, millions of people need to watch you drop your gloves. I mean, it appeared to be mandatory. So he went out and did it.
Yeah, that's a fascinating part of it. I mean, that almost reminds me or makes me think of the idea of going up in the plane, jumping over. I'm going to put quotations around this, overcoming your biggest fear, which I don't even know if that's the right way to put it, because you're pushing through it, but you're not okay with it, right? Which you alluded to in the book. It's like, I want to actually be okay with it. I don't want to just do it and then still have the fear hanging over me, right? And what happened when you came down and it didn't fix things?
Yeah, my initial reaction was, you know, disappointment. And I felt so sick from what I had done. And I knew I was supposed to be excited, but I just wasn't. And there was, you know, there was shame involved because I felt like, what's the matter with me? Why can't, you know, I did it. Why, what more do you want from me? You know? And then, so that was the initial reaction. And then, you know, when I started to realize, that was when I realized I really needed to do the work in terms of understanding what was happening to my body and my brain when I feel afraid. And when I started to dig into, you know, the science of exposure therapy is not just scare the crap out of yourself as much as you can. It turns out it's about training your brain and training your body and learning to stay calm gradually through the things that scare you. It's hard work, but it's not an instant fix. And it's not dramatically jumping out of a plane. It's slow, careful work to retrain yourself, which was the piece I hadn't understood before.
Now, before we dive into the nitty gritty and the specifics of, geez, just a few of the long list of incredible pieces of academia and insight into fear in your book, I wanted to ask, you said as a child, I think we can all relate to this, you don't really rationally understand things or you're not able to put a label on things. They're more just phenomena and experiences. You know, the idea of fear, now we can say, as you alluded to in your book, we can couple it under PTSD or phobias, which give us a different understanding. So this is a bit of a fully loaded question, but you now, I mean, and thankfully I do too, after reading it, have such an incredible understanding of fear from so many different viewpoints. What has it done to rationalize and understand fear neuroanatomically, hormonally, et cetera? How has that changed your approach to fear?
I think it's been pretty empowering to understand what's happening and to sometimes just accept it, you know, to not feel as embarrassed or ashamed as I might have before, to understand that I have coping mechanisms and strategies to feel less afraid, but also to understand that it's okay to just be afraid sometimes, that it will pass, you know, that it's natural. I remember in the, you know, early first few weeks of the pandemic last year, I would sometimes lie awake, you know, worrying about my parents or something else, you know, and my heart would just be racing. And I would say, okay, you know what's happening right now. You know, your pupils are dilated, your heart rate is accelerating. This is a fear response. It's, you know, just breathe. This is natural. You know, you're sensing a threat. And I would just sort of talk myself through the basic science. And it didn't make me less afraid of what the pandemic might do to the people I love, but it helped to just understand and remind myself that I knew what was happening. It's a natural process. It will pass. You know, that wasn't a fear that I felt the need to conquer. It was just something that was going to be something I would have to, you know, cohabitate with for a while.
One of the early points in your book are connected to that. And it's from one of my favorites, William James, talking about the fear. Imagine you had fear, but no physical sensations of fear. Would it still be the same? Kind of bringing up that question. When you were writing the book, why was it that you felt the need to put that in there?
It was such a revelation to me. You know, it was one of those things that makes sense as soon as you read it, but that maybe you haven't thought about consciously before. I certainly hadn't I thought fear is a feeling. Fear is an emotion, right? And when I started researching the science of fear, I was like, oh, actually, I hadn't understood the physicality of it. But then when it's pointed out to you, you're like, of course, fear is physical. Fear is, we react to it in all these bodily ways. And I hadn't put that together before. And William James just stated it so well, you know, what is there of fear without the physical reaction, without your chest squeezing and your heart racing and your goosebumps and all that stuff? What's left?
It's fascinating. As I study CBT right now in school, it's amazing the understanding has in our ability. It changes our, I don't know if it's a cognitive realignment, but being able to see things this way does something to us. And I haven't been able to articulate it, because I'm a big believer in, and I think this is where I'm going to shape any type of therapy I do, if and when I become a counselor, is I'm a huge believer of changing the global belief system, changing the lifestyle. And that's what I love to focus on. But I often miss this value of compartmentalizing and seeing the problem. You know, when you first realized that, when you realized that with William James, what did that shift in your mind? What did that shift in your approach to fear, or maybe next steps that you needed to take?
I think understanding it as a physical problem took some of the pressure off, feeling like I just needed to kind of be able to change my mind. You know, like in the moment when you're sort of panicking on the side of a mountain, understanding that that was a bodily process that had been triggered in me, I think it took some of the pressure off feeling like it was mental weakness on my part, you know. And then it's in the way that we tend to think about our, you know, our bodies, once it's a physical problem, it feels a lot more fixable. Of course, that's not always that simple, but reconceptualizing it as a physical situation made it feel more tangible and more like something that somebody could help me work on, I think.
So here's a question to be devil's advocate or ask on the contrary. Was there, through your journey of fear before or now after your depth of understanding, was there a time where you thought the opposite or leveraged the opposite, leveraged a belief in something else? Maybe it's religious, spiritual. Was there ever that process? And I know that that wasn't, at least from my knowledge, included strongly in the book. But was there a part where you had leveraged a spiritual approach to fear, and did it work or did it not work?
I don't think I have. No, I'm not a spiritual person really. And I never kind of leaned on those sorts of sort of more leap of faith type resources, to try to get through. The closest would be, you know, sort of almost, meditatively reciting Nirvana lyrics to myself on a hike once where I had to get through, and I just had to keep putting one foot in front of the other. But I don't know where that falls between, you know, but it was sort of a mantra that got me through. It was nothing on the top but a bucket and a mop, from Plateau. And I was, this is a lot up there, but don't be scared. That was probably the closest I came to sort of rather than thinking my way, you know, sort of very explicitly through the science, just trying to find something to hold on to get me through. But it's certainly, you know, even learning about the science and going through the experiences that I had with different therapies, I think made me more open-minded as well, though, to the things that we don't understand.
Because you have such a depth of knowledge now, and we're going to continue to unpack it. What is there that is, before we get into what we know, what was the biggest thing that you weren't able to figure out or that you're still very curious about today?
I still don't know why the fear of heights. You know, there's some different possibilities that I talk about in the bit in the book, but I don't know why I turned out the way I did in terms of that fear. I don't know why, and we don't, we, you know, broadly don't know why the EMDR therapy that I did for my trauma from the car accidents worked so well. We don't understand why that therapy works at all. we just know, you know, nowadays that it does, but it was dismissed as pseudoscience for a long time because we don't understand the mechanism. And there's something there in sort of mind body connection stuff that, that we don't have a grasp on. And I'm more inclined to just believe in that stuff now, I guess, because I've felt it work in me.
So I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but does that mean there's a little bit of a spiritual belief in something that we can't, articulate?
yeah, I think that would be fair. Yeah. You know, one thing I did, after my mom died, I was just trying to say yes to any help I could get. And there's a local organization called Hospice Yukon, and they, offer free, healing touch treatments. Healing touch is like similar to Reiki. It's like an energy healing treatment, for people who are grieving. And I just thought, you know what, I'm not into this stuff, but like an hour in a dark room is not going to hurt me at this point. And it was, I had this headache for months after my mom died that nothing would make this headache go away. Not any amount of water or coffee or drugs, you know? And, the only thing that made it go away was healing touch, was like having my chakras cleaned out. And I was never the person who was into that stuff, you know, but it was something I came to rely on. And I guess that's what I mean when I say that I sort of became more open-minded through this process and open to the idea that, that there's a lot of stuff we don't understand about, you know, our consciousness and our bodies and how all that stuff comes together.
What I really admire about you and your story is that there's some type of fire beneath you, some type of energy, something in you and who you are. And I know you alluded to, you know, really enjoying going on adventures, and in my biased belief of heroic philosophy and what I've learned, I think that's one of the most important things in life. And ultimately that journey to figure out and educate about fear has led you to this incredible place, at least outwardly, that I see that you're at today. And I really admire that. And I think it comes, you know, you said in the book, and I just want to touch on this as a bit of a side note, you said you could have just avoided heights. You could have had a life where you just avoided heights. You could have had a life where you just accepted that that life was going to be this little bit of sadness. What continued to keep that fire inside you as you started to uncover certain things? What kept you going if you weren't able to totally solve it? You overturned one rock and then another rock and then another rock.
Yeah, I just really felt like giving up would cost me too much. You know, when you weigh what you want out of life and what you want to achieve and what you want to be able to enjoy and, you know, the community you want to be a part of, giving up the mountains, you know, because I was too scared would have cost me too much, in terms of my professional aspirations, you know, as an adventure writer, in terms of my community, my sort of personal sense of accomplishment and fulfillment. It was too much to give up for me. And I wanted a bigger life than what I would have had if I just never went up hills or, you know, into exposed heights or areas that could trigger me. Yeah, I wanted more, I guess.
I love that. Now, stepping into a little more of the academic world, which again, we don't even have time to discuss half of the incredible content you provided in your book in such a digestible approach and tangible approach, which was amazing. I'm curious, when we talk about exposure therapy, was there a part of that therapy, that process for you where imagination, and I know you touched on in vivo in your book, in the approach for exposure therapy, did that work for you?
I didn't do much of the imaginative side. You know, the exposure therapy that I did was just with a workbook and not with a professional guiding me through it. And maybe if I had worked with a therapist, they would have helped me with some of the imaginative side, but I didn't. My focus was on the in vivo, and I don't know how much imaginative in my case would have, how far it would have gotten me before I had to move to the in vivo. I'm not sure. I definitely think I would have needed help to do it. I remember watching Free Solo and just being, you know, feeling absolutely ill, and I couldn't sleep for hours afterwards. So I certainly am sometimes affected as well by heights in more abstract cases, but I don't know if I could have on my own, just sort of imagined my way along the cliff and then had that be useful therapeutically. I think there are limits to what we can do without help, you know?
And as we continue to dive in here, the first president of the American Psychological Association described fear as the anticipation of pain. And is that still today what is used? Because I think that is a outstanding for me personally. I don't know how you feel about it, but I think that's an outstanding depiction of what pain is.
Yeah, I don't know how widely that's still used, but I thought it was fantastic as well. I thought that was just a perfect catch-all definition of fear, the anticipation of pain. It captures so many different, you know, fear has so many different facets and permutations and but that pretty well, as far as I can tell, captures all of them. It's brilliant.
When you are doing that climb with, and you're with a bunch of people and you're in your own head and you're scared and you're unsure. And I thought, is this going to be about heights and more physical pain and fear that's more external, as opposed to, you know, what about the fear of losing a job that's somewhat more internal, socially created? But the reason the anticipation of pain still exists because there's different types of pain. And that's why I thought that was just such a beautiful depiction of it, and helps you now approach it. Okay, this is an anticipation of pain. Now I can start to hopefully rationalize my understanding of, is this actually going to cause that much pain or not? I don't know if that's how it's helped you, but I guess how is that definition allowed you to understand fear in a better way?
Yeah. Like we talked about earlier, you know, being able to name something and understand it can be really helpful. And so understanding that so much of our, you know, fear, worry, or anxiety is sort of looking ahead and projecting, you know, projecting into the future to see the things that we fear kind of up ahead of us. I think that can be helpful, in a helpful reminder for anyone trying to sort of think their way out of a panic attack or something, you know, smaller than that as well.
You bring up an interesting point in your book that this fear response, I'm going to put in quotations, is supposed to allow us to live better or keep us, well, maybe not live better, keep us safe, right? But there's points, which you brought up, that it can actually falter and make things difficult or not work in our favor.
Yeah, it's you know, the perfect example, I think, is, you know, me having a panic attack behind the wheel because I've had previous car accidents does not make me safer. It makes me less safe to have a panic attack on the highway, right? That's an example of the fear reaction completely subverting its own purpose. And so I guess I always understood a fear reaction as being more toxic than helpful. And so for me, it was more about understanding the helpful side of it, and understanding that I needed my fear, but that I needed to figure out a way to kind of pick my moments better, you know? And I think finding that balance and that healthy relationship with fear, what it comes down to is what they call threat assessment, right? Is identifying the things that we should be afraid of versus the things that we don't need to be so afraid of.
While we're on the topic of the fear of driving, it was tough reading those chapters because of, it's like, I turned the page and it's like, I don't want to hear her go through another situation where she almost, you know, got hurt in a car accident. So when you went to EMDR therapy, from a purely anecdotal, subjective view, what did it do for you? Because you do a beautiful job of writing about the experience in your book. If you could, you know, give a condensed view of what that experience was like and what it did for you, which
it was surreal and it was, you know, kind of life altering. I felt it in my body. It was so strange. I love that quote I found from the woman who survived the Oklahoma City bombing and did EMDR afterwards for her trauma. And she says that EMDR was the strangest thing she had ever experienced other than the bomb. it's such a weird experience to feel your body seemingly acting on its own as you call up these memories, having these really powerful physical reactions as you're being sort of activated by the eye movements. And it's just so strange. And I wasn't, even with, you know, some of my more open-minded approach to things, with the healing touch and so on, I didn't expect it. I didn't expect how exhausted I was after each session. I didn't expect how strange and physical and powerful it would seem. It was a fascinating experience. And I've probably gotten the most emails and you know, notes and stuff on social media from people about that chapter, because a lot of people have had similar experiences or they're interested in trying it. I don't want to be too much of, you know, like a fangirl for just one method, because there's a reason why there's a lot of different types of therapies for different people. And it's about finding the one that works for you. But what a fascinating, strange practice. It stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And so it involves a therapist prompting you to move your eyes back and forth in kind of a rhythm from side to side. They can use sounds or lights to do that. Or in my case, sort of pulsing pods that I held in my hands, and they would alternate left and right. And when they pulsed, I just couldn't help it. My eyes moved. and they have you talk through the traumatic event that you're sort of hoping to resolve in terms of having the intrusive thoughts and post-traumatic symptoms and all that stuff while your eyes are going back and forth. And the analogy that I make in the book is, if a traumatic memory is sort of like a file sticking up out of a filing cabinet that won't let you close the door, when it works, EMDR seems to sort of like put the file back in its place, and then you can slide the drawer shut. It's not that it doesn't change your memory of your trauma. It doesn't, you know, alter your relationship to that, except that it prevents the memory from kind of coming out and grabbing you by the throat at random times or when you're triggered. It's like it makes it safe, which is a hard thing to explain. And they don't know why it works. You know, there's various studies that I looked into that I didn't end up getting into in the book because they're all sort of inconclusive so far, but they are looking at, you know, is the eye movement related to the way our eyes move when we're sleeping, which we know, you know, we know that REM sleep is involved in storage of memories. Is there something, you know, physical that connects eye movements to memory storage that we don't fully understand yet? They know that they have been able to measure changes in gray matter density before and after EMDR. They know it does something, but they just don't know what.
When I was reading it, I wonder, you know, it makes me think, and I know we're going to get to it, but if it has to do with to lower the feeling of that fear and realigning it with a new memory or turning down the response of that fear. Yeah, it was so amazing to read that. And it was so uplifting to read it, because imagine how that could change someone's life, you know, and as it did for you. I think that was a really cool part to read in the book. I'm so happy it worked, and others listening may be able to give it a shot and change their life as well.
Yeah, me too.
Moving into the next part in your book, and the fact that there's one pill can also, so you have this EMDR therapy that can change someone's life, and then you have one pill that can change someone's life. Can you take people through how one pill was able to change this fear response for you?
Right. So this is an experimental drug therapy that a psychologist in Amsterdam has developed, and I flew to Amsterdam to try it. It's primarily for specific phobias. She is trying to adapt it for trauma, but it's trickier because trauma is more complex than sort of a specific phobia, like a fear of cats or sharks or heights. So for right now, she's focused on treating phobias. And propranolol is a common beta blocker. Some people take it before public speaking. It's sort of, you know, it sort of has a temporary calming effect. But the way that she is deploying it in combination with some recent neuroscientific research into memory formation and storage, it has a more enduring effect in theory. And so what she does is she triggers your phobia as strongly as she can. And then that calls up in Dr. Kint's terminology, calls up the memory trace. And then she hits you with a dose of propranolol, one pill, and you're supposed to not get scared again for 24 hours. and then the next day she tries to trigger you again. And in an overwhelming number of cases, the phobic reaction is gone. Like it's been snipped out of you. It's, it sounds like science fiction. I've seen it compared to, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. It doesn't erase your fear memories. I can still remember every time I've panicked from heights. It's like it decouples the engine from the train, and you sort of leave all those, you know, freight cars full of scary memories back on the tracks behind you. It's very, again, very, I had some very strange experiences working on this book, and this one was pretty unbelievable.
Wow. And I'll leave it up to people to actually pick up the book, and because your story of it, I know you just gave us a glimmer of what it can do, but your story is quite outstanding, especially in a 24-hour window and just a short span of time to have such a catalytic effect is fascinating. So we'll end it that part there and let people pick up the book to find out more of that part. But then moving forward to the next part in the book was having to do with the amygdala, and that it's always referred to. And when I say always, I would say in everything I read is the fear center of the brain, emotion center. And it turns out still has a big influence on fear, but not necessarily everything to do with fear. And what you learned, you know, in that area, finding a woman that has a amygdala that has been damaged and isn't quite working. Before we get into the specifics on that, I would ask you, you know, is that how we would want to live? Would we want to live without fear? Because there are a lot of benefits to it, obviously. And I guess what you learned in that research of what is it like for someone living without any type of fear?
Yeah, I think that people, if they didn't think about it too deeply, would think, of course I want to be fearless. That sounds great. And the reality was not at all what I expected. You know, this woman, she's known to scientists as Patient SM. She has a very damaged amygdala, can't experience fear in the normal ways we think of it. And she's medically fearless, and her life is incredibly difficult. Not just in the ways you might think about, where, you know, she doesn't blink when someone holds a gun to her head, but also like it's hard for her to maintain friendships because she has no fear of rejection. And so she comes on, you know, really strong. It's not that she's unkind. She's apparently really kind, almost to the point of driving people away because she's like, let's be best friends. You know, I like you. It's like she's operating without guardrails in her life, which is a funny thing for most of us to think about when we're sort of plagued by insecurities all the time. You know, she sometimes forgets to eat. Stuff that you wouldn't think is connected to fear. It's all really hard in her life.
The biggest takeaway from that was the idea of fear and worry, and coming back to this idea of, okay, there's fear of heights, but then there's also these complex fears of social insecurities or complex ideas of losing a job, and then the trickle down effect of what that'll cause in someone's life, and how, again, this is what you alluded to, there's a little bit more complex situations that may not work as well for EMDR, but the difference between fear and worry, are you able to define the difference or cut the two in half and explain both on either side?
It's so hard. You know, I think for her, what's fascinating is that she's able to worry about other people, but never about herself. She has basically no sense of self-preservation on any level, you know, emotional, physical, financial. And she would still not say she's afraid for other people, but she would say, I worry about my kids. And it's interesting to think about, you know, going back to fear and love and how they can be connected, that one of the only ways she's able to experience what we might call fear is in relation to her love for other people. So I think that's something that's interesting to think about for all of us, not just, you know, remarkable famous scientific subjects.
Right. It when I was doing research on PTSD, they used to call PTSD a soldier's heart, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's just fascinating that connection, right? On a phenomenological approach of the connection between heart and mind, spirit and mind, global beliefs and mind, whatever you would want to call it. But that falls into this topic of fear. Actually, And it was so powerful in a individual that doesn't, you know, you put a gun to her head and there's no, not okay, just like they're ordering a cup of coffee. but then you bring up the love for someone else and all of a sudden it induces fear in some other part of the brain, which we're unaware of. That is, to me, that is just such a powerful takeaway of connection and meaning and purpose when it comes to other people in our lives. Somewhat winding down here, this book's, again, fully loaded. What was the most groundbreaking discovery for you? And if not there yet, what is it that's next on your list of something that you plan to discover when it comes to fear?
I think the most groundbreaking thing for me personally was just reframing my whole understanding of fear. For me, it was all bound up in you know, a sense of shame and embarrassment. I hated it, you know, I hated feeling fear. And now I am, you know, less afraid than I was before I did the book. You know, I was able to, you know, fix some things. I was able to, you know, quote unquote, conquer some stuff. But I also just, I value fear so differently now. And I think that's the real kind of seismic shift for me is understanding it as something that's necessary, that can be helpful, that it's not exactly a tool, but it's something that can have a powerful and useful role in your life if you can sort of get yourself calibrated to work with it in a positive way. And that was something I never expected. That was partly, you know, what Patient SM taught me is to value my fear response in a way that I really never had. For me, it had always been a burden and a source of shame.
You said something very powerful that I don't want to just glance over, is that you said you are less afraid in certain areas of your life. Like, and I want to come back to that and say, you really are, it's like more of a question. Like, you really are less afraid. That's possible. You know, as human beings, that's a quite powerful message to share. And yeah, so that's true. There's certain things in your life that you have that have less power over you, that you're less scared of now than you once were.
Yeah. I gotta be honest, I didn't expect that. I fully expected to write this book and have kind of nothing major really change in my life, and to write an epilogue that was kind of wishy-washy, where I was like, well, I didn't conquer my fears, but I learned a lot along the way, and I hope you did too, you know? But I made real change in my life in terms of the height stuff and the driving trauma, but also just really in my understanding of grief and loss, you know, that dread that I had of losing my mom. I still don't relish losing people I love by any means. Obviously it's going to happen again, and I'm not looking forward to that, but I really have a deep understanding of how I will come through it the next time now, I think. And so it doesn't hold the same terror that it did for me. I understand it, and I know that it will be hard, and I will eventually come through it. And that's a real, really kind of, you know, lightens your load, I think. And it comes and goes. There's days when I feel much more sort of weighed down by the idea that, you know, my dog's going to get hit by a car someday, or, you know, I'll lose my dad eventually too, or, you know, there's different things hang over you heavier some days than others, and particularly in the last year that we've had. But most of the time I feel more able to face, you know, loss without fear than I used to.
Amazing. As I'm listening to you speak here, have you ever had this thought of when you do feel fear, and it is, let's say, in fear of loss, does it ever remind you, you have that fear now that you understand it the way you do? Does it ever remind you, the reason I fear this is because I'm so lucky to have it?
It hasn't, but it probably will now. I think that's probably a useful thing to remind myself of in these moments is that, you know, losses are scary because we have something of value.
Right. I just thought of that now and how it relates to the hero's journey, which is very much, and we see this in religion and even in, you know, biology to a certain extent, that the evolution and the journey of death and resurrection kind of thing. I know that sounds very theological, but it's more just the death of some part of your life or the ending of one part of your life for the new journey and the next. So, of course, biased in trying to tie things into heroism, but I don't know if you had any other topics you wanted to discuss. Again, if I had a week, I think it would take that much time to unpack everything you put into your incredible book.
I don't think so. I guess I would just say, you know, my real takeaway from doing this book is that our fears are more changeable than we often realize. They feel permanent. They feel like they're a part of us, but they are malleable, you know, with some work and some thought and some time. And I think that's something that can feel impossible to remember when you're really in the grips of them, but they are more changeable than we realize.
That brings us to the end of another Heroic Minds podcast. If you want to learn more about Eva and her work, check her out on her website. Check out her book. The links are in the description of this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Ben Finelli. This is the Heroic Minds podcast. We'll talk again soon.